He held his lightsaber poised horizontally across his chest, its blue light casting everything beyond it, including Qui-Gon in black and white.
"This is the Padawan's dojo," Obi-Wan said.
"I was once a Padawan, you know."
Qui-Gon stepped farther into the dojo, looking up into its vaulted ceiling, where various handmarks and footprints testified to Padawans practicing more athletic styles of lightsaber combat.
"I didn't mean that you wouldn't know where it was."
Qui-Gon raised an eyebrow.
"You meant, what am I doing here, where I don't belong?" He seemed so calm, even amused.
Whatever generosity Obi-Wan had tried to feel toward his master weakened.
"I wasn't asking a question, actually."
The unspoken rebuke flowed around Qui-Gon like water. Qui-Gon Jinn might be an imperfect, unorthodox Jedi in many ways, but Obi-Wan had to envy his master's ease. Instead of either arguing with Obi-Wan about his right to be there or just walking out, Qui-Gon said,
"I wanted to apologize for this morning. That's not the way you should have learned about my invitation to the Council. I'd debated telling you, but thought I should wait until I'd made my final decision."
Obi-Wan bit back a bitter laugh.
"Are you seriously considering declining? Were you ever? I doubt it."
Qui-Gon sighed.
"Fair enough. Your reaction is understandable. But I have reservations. Concerns that I must resolve within myself before I can commit to a position of such responsibility.
Concerns you wouldn't dream of discussing with me."
That comment finally pierced Qui-Gon's damnable calm. There was an edge to his voice as he said,
"I suspected you would be too upset to discuss this rationally. Apparently I was correct."
"I thought you said my reaction was understandable,"
Obi-Wan shot back.
"So why does it disqualify me from hearing the truth?"
Qui-Gon put his hands on his broad belt, the way he did when he was beginning to withdraw into himself.
"We should discuss this at another time. Neither of us is his best self at the present."
Even through his mood, Obi-Wan knew Qui-Gon was right about that much. But he couldn't stand to drop it so easily.
"I've been asking myself why you've never trained me past the basic cadences."
He twirled his lightsaber, brought it down into a lower stance.
"You can't have thought my skill was inadequate. So why not move on? But now I think I know the answer."
"Enlighten me,"
Qui-Gon said dryly.
"Because you decided a long time ago that you'd get rid of me one way or another. That we wouldn't work as master and Padawan, so why bother planning ahead? Why even try? You knew it would be up to someone else to finish my training."
Obi-Wan flicked his lightsaber off.
"You turned out to be a prophet after all, master."
Qui-Gon remained silent so long that Obi-Wan first thought he'd won the debate. Finally, he replied,
"I kept you in the basics for a reason, Obi-Wan. And if you'd ever understood why, you might have understood me well enough for us to excel as master and apprentice. As it is, I suppose the Force sometimes ensures things turn out for the best."
His master walked out. For a long time, Obi-Wan remained in the dojo, battling his darker emotions and wondering all over again why Qui-Gon Jinn was such a mystery. Dully, he told himself,
"It's like Qui-Gon said, it's for the best."
But it didn't feel like it. There were some things Avaros had never gotten to like about Pygel, even after 8 years on this planet. Luckily, the food wasn't one of them. These people knew how to eat.
"You've invited the Jedi?"
Zerka Sector Supervisor Merritt Call raised an eyebrow as she motioned to the server to bring her another serving of the shock. The raised outline of the server's tracking chip was barely visible on top of her left hand, a few millimeters of metal that marked her enslavement. They dined in style at the palace.
"Of course help is needed. But private security companies could be called in."
"Hired guns won't care about anything but their paycheck,"
Rael Avaros said, picking up his shock leg by the bone. Sauce dripped down his fingers. Won't see anything their procedures haven't trained them to see. But a Jedi Knight? A Jedi can sort through this in a fifth of the time some mercenary would take.
Avaros sat at one head of the dark wooden table with its gold inlay. Princess Fanry sat at the other, the candle droid chandelier catching the iridescent threads in the scarf wrapped around her hair. Supervisor Call sat at his right hand in her usual starchy white uniform. Palace etiquette declared that the seat next to Fanry was the one of higher honor. But Avaros never had given a damn about etiquette. Besides, this meal was more than a formal banquet. It was a business meeting. Just one of the endless tasks Avaros undertook so Fanry wouldn't have to. But Fanry, while remaining poised and charming as a princess must, was obviously listening to him very carefully. She was doing exactly as he taught her to do. Always listen, always learn, always dig out more layers beneath court protocol. He smiled to himself and thought, "Atta girl." Supervisor Call was smiling too, but she remained unimpressed.
"That prompts the question, Lord Regent. If a Jedi can solve this problem so simply, why haven't you handled it?"
"Because the situation needs fresh eyes."
Avaros took another deep quaff of lunar wine in the hope it would blunt the edges of what he had to say. He didn't like admitting his weaknesses at any time, least of all when it came to protecting Fanry.
"I've lived on Pygel for 8 years now, Supervisor. Not just that, I've lived in the Royal Palace. The Princess's problems have been my problems. Her world's been my world. My view's the view from a castle window, and you know as well as I do, that view doesn't show you everything. Somebody new is going to pick up on things I won't."
But there was so much about Pygel that an outsider could never fully understand. As much as Avaros looked forward to Fanry's coronation, he could hardly imagine his life after that. He figured Fanry would ask him to stay on as an advisor, and he badly wanted to accept. But he also knew the council would insist upon his doing something new to prove he wasn't overly attached to any one place, any one mission. Avaros agreed with that general principle, but his work here on Pygel was different. He felt like he was doing real good, like he mattered. And his knowledge of the planet meant he had more to offer here than anywhere else. Of course, the council would never admit that, passive bureaucrats that they were. If staying on Pygel meant leaving the Jedi, Avaros didn't have a damn clue what he'd choose. Supervisor Call nodded thoughtfully, though her dark eyes still betrayed suspicion. Avaros knew she'd been a supervisor for more than 2 decades, gaining authority over commerce and more systems over the years. She was careful, canny, controlled.
"I take your point, Lord Regent. Yet we at Zerk are concerned that a new Jedi won't understand our arrangements on this planet. Even you took a while to perceive the correctness of what we do here."
"When I was young and naive," Avaros said with a grin. "Well, maybe not that naive."
He'd also been in the kind of pain that warped your mind, the kind you never got over, no matter how hard you tried, but that wasn't something Merritt Call needed to know. Call smiled politely, but pursued her point.
"What if the Order sends someone else, young and naive?"
"I've requested someone specific. The sharpest Jedi I've ever worked with. He'd never let us down."
It felt so good, Avaros thought, actually knowing who to trust.
"I'm surer of Qui-Gon Jinn than any other person I know."
Late at night, Qui-Gon remained awake in his quarters, a datapad providing the only light. He'd gone over this record before. Right after it happened, Qui-Gon had watched it repeatedly. as had others in the Jedi Order. Ultimately, the Council had vindicated Rael Averroes. Qui-Gon had never been sure it was the right decision. The cargo freighter Advent had been ferrying foodstuffs to a system suffering from desperate famine, with Rael Averroes and his Padawan supervising. Worries about pirate activity in that sector meant every external sensor was checked constantly. This took attention away from internal problems and kept anyone from recognizing the real danger. A bloody, violent mutiny. Standard procedures for a mutiny aboard such a freighter would have called for the Jedi on board to prioritize retaking the bridge. From the bridge, all other ship functions could be taken under control and help from other Republic vessels could have been summoned. Rael had other ideas. According to the reports of the official hearing, he'd suspected the mutineers might make a deal with the pirates, arms and assistance in return for the food supplies. With pirate help, the mutineers would have been much more difficult to defeat, and a threat to any Republic ships that came to the rescue. So Rael had taken his Padawan to the main cargo bay to seize that area first. Jedi could override protocols at their judgment, so long as they remained within their mandate for that mission. Rael's decision might not have attracted any notice, if not for the tragedy that followed. Qui-Gon watched the Advent footage of the moment the mutineers stormed the main cargo bay, slaughtering loyal crew members right and left with the aid of reprogrammed droids. Even the screams of the dying didn't stop them, but the sight of two lightsabers did. Into the fray leapt Averroes and his Padawan, a Thalothian in the first year of her training.
Nim Piona, Qui-Gon reminded himself. Her name was Nim Piona. She was more than just his Padawan.
Despite her youth, she braced herself for combat, igniting her green lightsaber simultaneously with Rael's blue blade. Together they fought as smoothly as though they were two parts of one being, displaying the kind of unity a master and Padawan were meant to have. The kind Qui-Gon had never managed to build with Obi-Wan. Qui-Gon's regrets were pushed into the back of his mind as the true horror began to unfold on screen. Rael and Piona were fighting their way across an elevated platform some 20 meters above the bay floor. Piona jumped toward one of the droids, not realizing it had been equipped with a slicer dart. The silvery dart jabbed into her temple, a perfect hit, and Piona stumbled to the side. Her eyes clouded over, the eerie sign of a brain and body temporarily enslaved by nanotechnology. The next events played out in mere seconds, but to Qui-Gon, they seemed to stretch into slow motion. They always had, no matter how many times he saw this, no matter how well he knew what happened next. Rael glimpsed his Padawan. Piona raised her lightsaber and charged him. Briefly, Rael hesitated. A decision was made. Master Averroes had to prioritize saving the hostages over saving his Padawan, Mace Windu had declared in the official council statement. Lightsaber duels, while very rare, are also deadly. He could not save her, and still have enough time to save the Advent. Averroes chose to prioritize the ship's safety above his apprentices. That is the choice she would have wanted him to make. Any Jedi would rather accept risk than endanger others. All very true. But Qui-Gon had never forgotten the look of pure terror and abandonment on Piona's face as she fell. Yes, her mind had been sliced, but she had still known her master. She was unable to control her actions, but her emotions had remained her own. Her master, the person she was supposed to be able to trust above all others in the galaxy, had killed her. That was the last thing she'd known before she died. She would never have been exposed to a slicer dart attack if Rael had obeyed protocols. Perhaps a Jedi Knight with a more conventional background wouldn't have been excused so easily. But Rael was an extreme latecomer to the temple, fully 5 years old before he was identified on Ringo Vinda. The oldest youngling ever brought in, so far as Qui-Gon knew. Those years made a profound difference. Rael had never fully mastered the subconscious controls that were trained into most Jedi from infancy. The members of the Abaros family were people he missed terribly. The large majority of Jedi didn't know their birth families at all. The exceptions went no further than speaking, on rare occasions, to relatives who were little more than strangers. Rael's manners were rough. Those of the orbital station rat he'd been, rather than the Jedi he hoped to become. He never lost his Ringo Vinden accent. Some children would have been ashamed of this. Others would have worked as hard as possible to conform to the companion's ways. Not Rael. He had gone in the opposite direction, using his station rat slang, remaining informal in every situation, and wearing clothes that a laborer would have thrown away as rags. In this way, he tried to bandage the wound of his lost childhood, but it was a wound that never healed. No one at the temple was fooled by Rael's defiance, not even himself. So he was treated with compassion. Even Dooku, who was in most ways a strict master, had made allowances for Rael. As a result, Rael had flourished as both a Jedi and an iconoclast. He'd become a brilliant pilot and a lightsaber master, and had served the Order nobly for many years. So after the Advent incident, the Jedi had made allowances once again. And for the first time, Qui-Gon thought, those allowances had gone too far. He knew Rael better than most in the Order did, which was why he doubted the official explanation for why the cargo bay had been targeted ahead of the bridge. In Qui-Gon's opinion, Nim Piona's life had been risked and lost, mostly because Rael wanted a straight-on fight instead of the tedious work of overriding bridge controls. That didn't mean Rael had been completely reckless. After 4 years teaching Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon could understand that losing a Padawan would be one of the most intensely painful experiences a master could endure. So he hadn't challenged the findings. When he'd learned that the Council had given Rael a long-term faraway mission, Qui-Gon had liked to think of his old friend in a place where he had time to meditate and could do some humble good as a means of penance. In this way, he might find peace. But no. These past 8 years, Rael Avaros had been living in a palace, ruling a world. Obi-Wan would only have been a youngling when this happened. Probably he'd never heard anything of the tragedy aboard the Advent. In Chancellor Kaj's office, Obi-Wan had betrayed no recognition of the name Rael Avaros. It felt like the worst possible time to talk with Obi-Wan about a master killing his Padawan, but Qui-Gon would tell him the whole story as soon as possible. Maybe he wouldn't be Obi-Wan's master much longer, but in that time, Qui-Gon would give him nothing but honesty. Obi-Wan deserved that much at least. He received a message. Putting aside the records, Qui-Gon turned to his comm, then raised his eyebrows in surprise. When he turned it on, a hologram took shape in his quarters.
Master Yoda, can I help you?
Wished to speak to you, I did.
About the mission to Pygel?
Among other things.
Yoda studied Qui-Gon carefully.
Linked strongly to Avaros, are you? Yet that connection has not always been best for you both.
Rael's always been a friend to me.
The defense was almost automatic. If he's something of an outsider, I don't think that's a bad thing. Yoda's ears flattened, a sure sign of irritation.
Think you we judge on such trivial things?
Of course not, Qui-Gon admitted. If you did, you wouldn't have picked me for the council, would you?
Pick you, I did not. Unsuited you are in many ways. Yet the council has spoken. And by that decision, I shall stand.
It took Qui-Gon a moment to process what he'd heard. Yoda hadn't wanted him for the council? Maybe it shouldn't have mattered in light of the fact that Yoda wasn't opposing the invitation any longer, but it felt like a kick to the gut. Did you call just to flatter me? Unsurprisingly, Yoda didn't take the bait.
Dooku is the link between you and Avaros. Of Dooku, you must speak. Ominous is his absence from the Jedi. More understanding for his reasons for leaving we need.
At the moment, it was easy for Qui-Gon to imagine reasons not to deal with Yoda.
I'll ask, he promised. I'll find out what I can.
Yoda nodded, and the hologram shimmered out of existence, leaving Qui-Gon to wonder why, when the rest of the council embraced him, Yoda had not.
Chapter 8.
Obi-Wan had many duties aboard the transport to Pygel. First, he volunteered to help the crew double-check cargo manifests. Tedious work, but important, as these materials would help build the modern spaceports needed for the new hyperspace corridor. Then he felt he should discuss the finer points of handling a consular-class cruiser with the pilot. After all, Obi-Wan loved flying and wanted to become an even better pilot, so he ought to learn about as many kinds of craft as possible. Once they were en route, he went along with the engineers to check the cruiser's sensor dish, just in case repair assistance was needed. What with one thing and another, he managed to avoid Qui-Gon until the final hour of the journey to Pygel.
Padawan,
Qui-Gon said as he ducked into the service tunnel where Obi-Wan was triple-checking some readings no one had asked for.
The crew seems to have the ship well in hand.
I only wanted to help, Obi-Wan protested, then stopped himself. Maybe Qui-Gon had failed to be honest with him, but that was no reason for Obi-Wan to be dishonest in return.
I haven't known what to say, so I was avoiding you. Not very mature.
You're extremely mature for a 17-year-old, whereas I'm 40, and I let you get away with it for hours.
Qui-Gon had always been quick to admit his own faults and errors, a kind of humility rarer among the Jedi than it should have been. Obi-Wan had always respected this trait in his master.
I ought to have said before, congratulations on being invited to join the Council. It's a very great honor. They'll be lucky to have you.
You really think so?
That made Qui-Gon chuckle.
Thank you, Obi-Wan. I thought probably you pitied them.
Of course not.
As difficult as their partnership had sometimes been, Obi-Wan realized he would miss it. Whatever had gone wrong between them wasn't all Qui-Gon's fault, and there had been more to learn from this man, which now Obi-Wan would never know.
I wanted to talk to you about Rael Avaros, said Qui-Gon, becoming grave. You probably have some questions.
Actually, after Chancellor Kaj described him as controversial, I went digging for answers on my own.
Obi-Wan's mood darkened as he remembered the footage he'd seen of the long-ago mutiny on the Advent.
What did you think after Nim Piano's death?
Qui-Gon said nothing at first. He simply gestured for Obi-Wan to walk out of the cramped service area into one of the main corridors of the cruiser. They were the only passengers other than the crew, so the corridor was empty save for an astromech busily at work on a distant panel. Was his master searching for a private place for them to speak? Obi-Wan wondered. Or maybe his questions had pushed too far. Then Qui-Gon leaned against the wall to gaze at the electric blue light of hyperspace, visible through one long oval viewport. His voice was heavy as he said,
Rael was reckless. Bad enough to be reckless with your own life, but criminal to be reckless with another's. Worst of all, to be reckless with your Padawans.
What?
Obi-Wan caught himself.
I mean, you didn't accept his reason for going to the cargo hold.
I think Rael probably believed in his own rationale. But he believed what he wanted to believe. We all do that sometimes.
Qui-Gon's gaze went distant for a moment, as though he was thinking of something else, but he went back to his topic. Rael Averroes never had the patience for complicated tasks, like going through levels of computer security to slice his way onto a bridge. He violated mutiny protocols in favor of doing something he liked better, whether he ever consciously realized that or not. And his Padawan paid the price. It did put Obi-Wan's issues with Qui-Gon into perspective. Chancellor Karsh said you were the best person to deal with Rael Averroes. That you knew each other before. Were the two of you friends? In a manner of speaking. Qui-Gon began strolling back toward the bridge, and Obi-Wan fell into step beside them. We shared the same master. Rael was Dooku's apprentice before me. As fate would have it, we were on several missions together those first few years. So we got to know each other rather well. He helped me see what kind of man Dooku was and how best to serve him. He helped teach me, even introduced me to the prophecies, as a matter of fact. We weren't intimates, but we forged a bond of trust, which I believe survives. If only there had been someone to tell Obi-Wan how to handle Qui-Gon. How can you think of him as a friend when you judge his actions so harshly? This earned Obi-Wan a look. We were friends, my Padawan. I believe on some level we still are. But that changes nothing. Never assume your friends are above wrongdoing. Even good people can make terrible mistakes. But I believe they should be helped to understand and account for those mistakes, a point of view the Council doesn't share. At least, not when it comes to Rael Averroes. Obi-Wan's curiosity sharpened. Why? Is there some particular reason the Council didn't hold Averroes accountable? Rael was an unusual case. The Seekers didn't find him in infancy, as they do most Force-sensitive children. He wasn't identified until he was 5 years old. 5? Obi-Wan at first thought he must have misheard. I was brought in late, and I was only 3. Qui-Gon nodded.
I doubt the Council will ever again accept a Padawan so old. Those years made the difference between Rael thinking of Ringo Vinda as his home rather than the temple. It shaped his attitudes, his progress, even the way he speaks, as you'll hear for yourself. As such, Rael Averroes was always something of an outsider. Rare allowances were made for him from childhood all the way to the hearings on Nimpiana's fate. It's always better to err on the side of mercy, but I suppose I'll always wonder.
I suppose that's something you'll have to deal with once you're on the Council, Obi-Wan said.
The Council must have come to understand that some of Qui-Gon's criticisms were valid. Maybe Obi-Wan should have been looking harder for that validity a long time ago. Qui-Gon didn't answer the question directly.
My invitation to the Council isn't relevant at the moment. And what Rael Averroes did in the past mustn't overshadow our mission. Our attention has to be on Pygel and the Princess. Don't lose sight of the now.
I won't, Obi-Wan promised.
It was one of those promises he couldn't be sure of keeping, but he made it anyway. Millennia ago, according to local legend, Pygel had been one of the first worlds to adopt planetary shield technology. Qui-Gon suspected the equipment had not been updated since. He and Obi-Wan stood on the small observation deck of the Corellian cruiser, taking in the vast spacescape before them. Both the planet itself, broad blue oceans, smallish continents in green and gold, and its moon, darker green, densely wooded. Neither Pygel nor its moon looked especially noteworthy, but the shield technology was another matter. The ancient clay-colored shield generators, 12 of them, slowly orbited Pygel, projecting almost invisible glinting golden beams that swirled outward to form the shield such as it was.
This can't be a fully operational shield, Obi-Wan protested.
Generators this old couldn't possibly produce enough energy.
Qui-Gon inclined his head. That depends upon your definition of fully operational. The Pygel shield doesn't prevent ships from flying in or out, but it never did.
and was never designed to. It exists to shelter the world from the extreme solar flares that arrive every decade or so.
I see, Master,
Obi-Wan said. But surely newer and more efficient generators would be safer. These look as though they might fall to pieces at the tap of a micro-asteroid. Replacing the technology is expensive, and Pygel's prosperity faded a long time ago. Qui-Gon folded his hands together within the broad sleeves of his robe. But it looks as though Zerka Corporation plans to step in. In the distance was an enormous Zerka ship, a branch-class vehicle, which would serve as a manufacturing center, personnel transport, and office complex. The cruiser's bridge infoscreen identified this as the Leverage, under the command of Sector Supervisor Merritt Call. Obi-Wan said,
Zerka's everywhere, it seems.
And has been for thousands of years. The corporation was so ancient, some believed it might even predate the Republic. The facts had long since been lost to time. If the hyperspace corridor is opened soon, maybe Pygel won't be so dependent on Zerka. They could make their own repairs. In the nick of time, it seems. Obi-Wan shook his head in disbelief. Hard to believe anyone on the planet could sleep at night with a solar shield this weak. How sheltered he still is, Qui-Gon thought. Some of their missions had taken them to less developed worlds, but Obi-Wan persisted in thinking of them as the exceptions rather than the rule. To him, normal meant Coruscant. Why should the Jedi raise so many of their younglings on the richest, busiest planet in the galaxy? It made sense for the Jedi Council to be located there at the center of government, but Council members didn't need to be in constant contact with the younglings.
Perhaps we might move more of the schools, or at least the creches, Qui-Gon thought. There are numerous worlds safe enough for us to shelter the younglings where life is lived more simply, in ways more familiar throughout the galaxy. Where the children might be surrounded by farmland or fisher beings. Where we interact more with the communities around us. And train new Jedi to be as much a part of the worlds as separate from them. He caught himself. He was focusing on the future rather than the present. The lecture he'd given Obi-Wan would have been better delivered to himself.
What in the worlds is that? Obi-Wan pointed to a small spherical vessel rising slowly from the planet in the direction of the closest shield generator. Probably its tiling had been pure white long ago, but countless re-entries into atmosphere had left gray charring around seams and edges.
Didn't you review the planetary report?
That was unlike Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon thought.
Those are the Soul Craft, ships that go back to the first settlers of this planet thousands of years ago. At some point, apparently, the local form of force worship began urging pilgrims to travel into space periodically to experience the darkness and zero gravity for themselves, so as to make them truly grateful for the beautiful planet they had. For some reason, circles and spheres tend to be sacred shapes on Pygel.
That's a soul craft! Obi-Wan was practically sputtering. But of course I read the report, Master. I can't believe they're still using ships that old.
I believe over time the Soul Craft have gained a certain talismanic quality of their own. They're valued because they're ancient, not in spite of it.
Though Qui-Gon wondered how long such belief would last, when, not if, one of these ships failed. As though his thought had summoned it, a blue flare of plasma energy erupted from the Soul Craft side.
Blast.
Qui-Gon wheeled around to the data terminal. Radiation levels were terrifyingly high. Plasma venting into space, but not into the ship itself. Not yet.
It's exploding.
Obi-Wan hurried to the navigator's chair.
The ship finally failed.
The explosion is external, the cruiser's navigator said, gesturing toward the ice-blue haze of energy rippling into the space around the Soul Craft. That's an incendiary device.
A plasma bomb?
Qui-Gon took a deep breath. Those were crude weapons, but powerful, used by attackers with few resources and no limits on cruelty.
If the plasma fully penetrated the Soulcraft, the death suffered by those within?
The plasma explosion still external?
Qui-Gon asked. When the answer was a nod, he pointed toward the Soulcraft.
Get us within 10 clicks immediately.
You can't get any closer to that thing,
the navigator protested, meaning, I can't.
You'll fry yourself and everyone else on this ship.
Not if we act quickly.
Qui-Gon shucked his robe, preparing for what lay ahead. As his garment fell to the floor, Obi-Wan's fell beside it. Some Padawans might have hesitated, but not his.
You heard my master, Obi-Wan said to the navigator. Take us in.
Years before, I am a Padawan of the Jedi.
Qui-Gon told himself as their shuttle drew closer to the forbidding black surface of Shurupak.
I'm good with my lightsaber. I've been apprenticed to Dooku for 4 months. I'm ready for battle.
Surely the Council agreed, or they wouldn't have sent him here with his master. But he gripped his lightsaber hilt more firmly when the ship shuddered again. They'd come under heavy weapons fire 4.3 minutes ago, according to the ship's chrono. Qui-Gon suspected the chrono was broken, though, because it felt much, much longer.
Coming in for landing!
Shouted Master Elio, as the shuttle began the telltale shimmy that meant they'd hit atmosphere.
We'll be at Primus Base within 5 minutes!
From the pre-mission briefing, Qui-Gon knew that Primus Base wasn't on the front line of battle. It was a whole 300 kilometers away. But 300 kilometers had seemed like a much bigger distance during the briefing than it did now. Next to him, Master Dooku remained as tall and stoic as a tree. He was truly fearless, in a way most Jedi could only appear to be. Instead of offering explicit support to Qui-Gon, he was providing an example to aspire to. Qui-Gon resolved to live up to that example if he could, assuming they didn't get blown up. The shuttle took one more burst of fire as it neared the ground, rocking it back and forth so that even the most experienced Jedi stumbled. Qui-Gon managed not to fall down, barely, but felt as if he'd only just gotten his balance when the shuttle trembled again. That was the feel of landfall. When the door swung open, everyone hurried forward, splashing onto a beach at low tide, still puddled with water. The wet sand dragged at Qui-Gon's boots, but he hurried to keep up with his master's long stride. Every few seconds, the echoing boom of battle sounded, and the horizon lit up, but he tried very hard not to hear or see. He reached the border gate of Primus Base just as Dooku did. His master was a veteran of many military campaigns, so Qui-Gon expected him to look calm. To his astonishment, when he looked up, Dooku was smiling?
Rail!
Dooku called in a sonorous voice. He marched forward, his dark green cape rippling in the harsh Shurupak wind, to greet the young man who stood before them. Short for an adult, his black hair rumpled in a dozen directions, wearing a ragged cloak and boots that looked older than Dooku himself. Of course Qui-Gon knew the name Rael Averroes, a famous lightsaber duelist and Dooku's first Padawan, but it couldn't be the same Rael. This person had to be a refugee. But Rael cheerfully called,
Master! About time you got here. You were on the verge of missing all the fun.
You always did enjoy combat more than you should. Dooku's amusement eclipsed his disapproval.
When they reached him, Rael quickly embraced Dooku, a gesture that startled Qui-Gon nearly as much as the fact that Dooku allowed it.
Seems like longer than 5 months since we've seen each other,
Rael said. You spent 10 years seeing me nearly every day. I should have thought that would be enough.
This was what passed for humor with Dooku.
Meanwhile, I've taken a new apprentice, Qui-Gon Jinn.
Qui-Gon nodded in greeting. Rael's grin widened as he bent down to inspect his successor.
I'm finally taller than someone. About time!
Before Qui-Gon could feel embarrassed, though, Rael put his foot next to Qui-Gon's own.
Okay, I see it now. You're gonna outgrow me in no time. When the rest of you catches up to your feet, you'll be as tall as our master. Maybe taller. Dooku, someday you're going to have to get used to not being the biggest guy in the room.
Dooku shook his head, tolerant of teasing from Rael to a degree Qui-Gon would have believed impossible. Or maybe Dooku was only focusing on the battle to come, because he strode away across the dark green Shuru-Pak sands to confer with the nearby generals. In the distance, through the fog, Qui-Gon could make out stun cannon tanks and troop transports. The horizon lit up again with weapons fire, and Qui-Gon shivered. Rael put one hand on his shoulder. If he comforted Qui-Gon, the embarrassment might be worse than the fear. Instead, Rael said,
Master Dooku can seem stiff sometimes. Know why that is?
Qui-Gon shook his head no, and slowly Rael's grin widened.
That's because he is stiff. Like a plank. Even in his sleep. How does he do that?
Qui-Gon couldn't help laughing.
I don't know. Never figured it out either.
Rael straightened, now addressing Qui-Gon as an equal.
Dooku's a hard guy to get to know. Eventually you're gonna feel like you can tell him anything, but it's gonna be a while, right? Well, listen. Sometimes a master's previous Padawans help out the newer ones, if they get the chance. It looks like we do. So any questions you have that you might not feel comfortable asking Dooku yet, you bring them to me. We can spar, too, if you want.
The prospect of fighting a dueling expert like Rael Avaros would have seemed intimidating at any other time. With his first battle looming, however, Qui-Gon couldn't worry about much else.
I'd like that.
Good. Come on, then. Let's talk to the generals.
Rael made it sound like a natural thing for a 12-year-old to do. Qui-Gon felt as though Rael Avaros were the bridge. The link between the Padawan he was and the Jedi Knight he so desperately wished to be. The journey would be easier now that he had a friend to show him the path.
Chapter 9. Princess Fanry felt frozen to her throne. She could not bear to watch the horror playing out on the screen in front of her, but she couldn't look away either. She didn't deserve to look away while her people suffered. While they died.
This is turning into a nightmare, she said, her throat tight with tears. I never thought it would come to this.
Why not? Snapped Minister Orth, a tall, rangy woman whose salt and pepper curls were pinned haphazardly atop her head. It was the only haphazard thing about Orth, whose dark brocade dress was stitched tightly from ankles to throat. Why wouldn't Helena Zaka follow things through to their natural conclusion? This was inevitable. There's nothing the opposition won't stoop to.
Fanry braced herself. You will be queen, she thought. You must not be weak. Pygel doesn't need a weak queen.
Instead, she looked up at tall, grave Captain Darren, who hadn't left her side since the latest report. His expression remained calm, only his eyes betrayed his sadness. To her, he said,
The Leverage reports they'll be on the scene soon. Supervisor Call has taken charge personally. We may yet avoid any loss of life.
Will Zerka be the savior of the day? Fanry wondered. I should have ordered more patrols, so my forces could rescue these people themselves. Look, Your Serene Highness.
One of the technicians shyly pointed to a blur at the edge of the screen.
It looks as if one or two other ships are already coming to help. There's a transport. A big one. A consular-class cruiser.
Instantly, Fanry knew what that meant. Her pulse leapt as she turned to Darren and whispered,
The Jedi.
Don't be afraid.
Dooku's voice rang out over even the howling winds of Shurupak.
Qui-Gon clung to the carbon fiber rope riggings of the Shurupakian ship, salt spray stinging his face and hands as they rounded the cape to approach the battle from an angle the enemy wouldn't expect.
They are shielded against skycraft and energy weapons, not against seafaring vessels.
He made this sound majestic, courageous, brilliant. Nothing like the last-minute, last-ditch attempt it actually was. Qui-Gon took a deep breath and stared up at the stars. Big mistake. The stars weren't moving, and his stomach was, and the queasiness that swept through him made him feel weak. It was as though the fear of hanging on to the rigging was doing the work for him, more than his will.
"Come on, hang in there!"
called Rael, who clung to the rigging just behind him.
"You'll be all right, kid. The first battle's always the worst."
"It's not the battle I'm afraid of,"
Qui-Gon protested.
"It's the water."
"The water?"
Despite the chill of the seawater drenching his clothes and hair, Qui-Gon's face flushed warm with embarrassment.
"I can't swim."
Now Rael Averroes, the Padawan before him, the stronger one, the better one, would laugh at him. And no bravery in combat would ever eclipse Qui-Gon's shame. Rael didn't laugh.
"Don't worry,"
he called over the roar of the waves.
"You fall in, I'll levitate you out. And after we've won this thing tomorrow, I'll teach you to swim."
He made the victory sound inevitable. Tonight, battle, and then came tomorrow. It erased Qui-Gon's fear faster than anything else could have done.
"I've never taught you to swim, have I, Obi-Wan?"
Obi-Wan looked up from his spacesuit fittings, confused.
"No, Master. But I know how. Well, a little bit. We'll practice."
Qui-Gon insisted as he fastened his own spacesuit.
"Every Jedi should be able to swim like a Mon Calamari."
Obi-Wan paused, and Qui-Gon could almost hear his Padawan's thoughts.
"So why didn't you teach me before? And when exactly are we going to practice? After you joined the Council?"
These were excellent questions, but Obi-Wan was too good to ask them aloud.
"We're approaching the Soulcraft, Master."
"He's making the transition to no longer thinking of me as Master," Qui-Gon told himself. "Before you join the Council, you'd better adjust as well."
"All right, seal up."
Once they were encased in their spacesuits, Qui-Gon hit the panel that cycled the airlock. As the room depressurized, he double-checked the energy shield and personal thrusters at his belt, fully charged. He and Obi-Wan exchanged glances. This is it. Before the external shield dropped, exposing them both to deep space. Qui-Gon pushed off into the void, and as soon as he was clear of the transport, hit the accelerator. The energy shield shimmered greenish around him as he was propelled forward through space, more like a ship or a missile than a man. Most sentients couldn't master the muscle control to remain functional within a thruster accelerator shield. Even many Jedi found it difficult. But over many years, Qui-Gon had gotten the knack. Obi-Wan had mastered it in only a few weeks. There were skills no one could easily teach. A person possessed them or didn't, and Obi-Wan possessed this. An accelerator shield essentially sheathed its wearer within an energy blast. The toughest part, usually, was to deactivate the acceleration in time to steer away from a collision that would be as destructive to the wearer as to its target. However, plasma fire interacted with accelerator shields in unusual ways. Ways that at this moment were very useful to Qui-Gon Jinn. The interaction would also be very painful, but not for long. That didn't matter. He simply needed to mentally prepare for it. As the Soulcraft grew closer, it seemed to expand in Qui-Gon's vision until it had almost erased space around it. The instant the surrounding blackness had disappeared, he braced himself for impact, calling on the Force for strength. It hit him. It owned him.
Every bone, every cell, every atom of his being seemed to resonate on a different frequency from every other, painful and strange. But it lasted only a moment. Then he was able to steady himself against the hull of the Soulcraft. Qui-Gon looked up to see that Obi-Wan, too, was in position. Plasma fire rippled around them, a sickly green haze of light that seemed to be writhing. Horrifying as it looked, the writhing was a good sign. The accelerator shields had set into motion a chain reaction that would eventually dull the plasma to nothingness. Meanwhile, he and Obi-Wan could help the process along. Already, Obi-Wan had his field laser in his hand, a thin white beam carving up the plasma as though it were a gelatin, sending small blobs scattering into space where they would soon harmlessly dissipate. Qui-Gon got to work as well, hacking through the stuff as quickly as possible. The Soulcraft had begun an emergency descent toward Pygel, but at this rate, they'd finish their work long before the ship hit the scorching resistance of the atmosphere.
If we're so far from the atmosphere, why is the Soulcraft already outlined in light?
The faint glow around the spherical Soulcraft's horizon sent horror jolting through him. Another plasma fire, Qui-Gon thought, his skin prickling as his hair stood on end. A second incendiary device. Separate from the first. Still fully active. How much good could his field laser be against that? It didn't matter. Qui-Gon had to handle this himself if he could. The risk was too great for Obi-Wan to be exposed to it. First, he attempted to reach out with the Force, but plasma responded poorly to such commands. Next, he reached for the magnetic tethers that would allow him to move across the hull toward the second plasma fire. But as he did so, a small distant shape darted into range and fired a single anti-plasma charge at the Soulcraft. The charge hit the second plasma fire, dousing it to darkness. Vibrations rippled through the ship again at the impact, but the magnetic tethers kept him in place. Qui-Gon's relief shifted into curiosity as the unknown vessel, a light freighter he thought, darted away. Who could their savior have been? Why didn't they want credit for what they'd done? Maybe the mystery rescuers wanted only what Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan wanted. The safety of those inside. Pax Marifer's voice was sharp enough to cut through a Mandalorian shield.
What in the blazing fires of Lola Seyu was that?
That was an anti-plasma charge. From a place in the pilot seat, Rahara Wick pushed the engines to the max, making sure they'd be safely hidden behind the moon long before any other ships took notice. I would have thought you'd know an anti-plasma charge when you saw one.
I am not addled. Of course I'm capable of recognizing an anti-plasma charge.
What I don't recognize is why you would insist on our anonymity for protection from Zerka Corporation, and then do something almost guaranteed to attract attention. Something risky. Something utterly unnecessary. Rahara inhaled deeply. She reminded herself that the Marix was Pax's ship, not hers. So as long as she was aboard, she had to try to get along. But that didn't mean never doing the right thing.
Look. She stabbed at the screen with one finger. Their manifest wasn't locked, so this was here for everyone to see.
The screen read, 15 passengers, 37 items of sentient property.
That means Zerka property.
Rahara felt her throat beginning to tighten. No, she couldn't tell Pax all of this again and hope that this time he got it. She'd just tear up. And displays of emotion weren't the way to get through to Pax.
Let's get this straight. If I see people like that in that kind of trouble, and there's something I can do to help them, I'm going to do it.
If you can't accept that, then find yourself another pilot.
By Elath, such drama!
Pax held up his hands in sarcastic alarm.
A
It's not as though I were about to toss you out the nearest airlock. I merely wanted to know why you did it. You have told me. Therefore, our conversation has come to a satisfactory conclusion.
Brahara knew that Pax was capable of feeling deep kindness and compassion, even if that better side was difficult for him to express.
Sometimes, however, he simply lacked the emotional savvy to look past the practical aspects of any situation.
So was he genuinely sympathetic to what she'd done, or did he simply not care as long as they were both fine? It didn't matter to her either way, or it shouldn't, at least. She'd saved the lives of 15 free people and 37 items of sentient property. That was good enough for one day.
Obi-Wan had thought it would be a relief to pass through the airlock into the Soulcraft. At this point, it seemed, the Zerka Corporation ship would arrive to rescue them before the Soulcraft had to test its damaged hull on re-entry. Still, he didn't like being isolated in deep space without a ship around him. But then he got inside the Soulcraft and realized, for the first time, what it was like to be with dozens of people and without gravity.
"Sorry,"
called one woman as she collided with Obi-Wan's legs.
"I'll try to push off over here."
But as soon as she was gone, a man, even larger than Qui-Gon, bumped into him and knocked his helmet against the wall. He and Qui-Gon were tethered to the interior hull with short cables, but the pilgrims inside floated freely. They wore simple white unitards or gray coveralls, seemingly designed for this purpose. And those with longer hair had taken the precautions of braiding or tying it back, or wearing tight-fitting caps. But apparently part of the religious element of the pilgrimage kept them from strapping into their seats at any time other than ascent and descent. The rest of the time, regardless of any crisis or of unexpected rescuers coming in through the airlock, they were spiritually commanded to fly free. Obi-Wan had never felt queasy in zero-G before, but that had always been in the darkness of space, when he was more or less looking only at distant ships or stationary planets and stars. Now, with bodies in every orientation, bobbing and twisting around him, his stomach churned. A shudder went through the ship, followed by the dull, heavy metallic thud of the engines shutting down. He relaxed as he recognized the pull of a tractor beam, no doubt pulling them toward the Zerka vessel leverage, which would have gravity. Wonderful, soothing, underappreciated gravity.
"Breathe easy," Qui-Gon said. He sounded faintly amused and didn't appear to be queasy at all. Maybe once you were a Jedi Master, little things like lack of gravity could no longer concern you. Obi-Wan hoped to reach that stage soon. Slowly, gravity began to take hold within the ship. As people began settling lower in the sphere, both Jedi unclipped their cables and descended to the floor along with them. Some of the Pyjalis seemed as relieved as Obi-Wan did, though most of them seemed, oddly, let down. Sad, even. Maybe they hadn't gotten the full religious experience they'd hoped for. Then he noticed that the quieter people all wore the gray coveralls rather than white unitards. They also had odd bulges atop their left hands. It looked as though something flat and rectangular had been inserted between skin and muscle. Obi-Wan turned to Qui-Gon and murmured,
"Their hands. For scanning as part of cargo manifests,"
Qui-Gon said quietly. "Oh, these people were enslaved." Obi-Wan had of course seen enslaved people before. The practice, though abolished by the Republic, was still widespread throughout the galaxy. But most he'd seen were part of smaller groups. A household staff, a farm's crew, extra dock workers. He'd never seen any of them fitted with tags as part of an enormous corporate organization, or he simply hadn't noticed. Maybe Qui-Gon hadn't either. His master studied the downcast faces around them, his gaze almost as sorrowful as theirs. With a thud, the soul craft settled onto a hard surface, the floor of Zerka's ship's docking bay. The airlock spun open, and the